Thanks so much for joining us again. This is another episode of Smart City Policy Stories. And as always, we're bringing you interesting conversation about different issues that we're facing in local communities around the country and around the world. We're excited to have with us Chris Herbert. He's the Managing Director at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's good to be with you.
You know, I saw you up at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and for everybody listening, you know, we certainly have a history of speaking to mayors on this show and talking about local government issues. The U.S. Conference of Mayors is such a spectacular organization. It brings together at any given one of their meetings, hundreds of mayors from around the country who are talking about best practices and model examples and sharing the stories so that they can do better when they go back home. And, you know, Chris, sometimes people don't realize how many local governments we're dealing with around the country, but I often use 23,000 as the kind of the number. Do you have a number you use when you talk about local governments around the country?
I wouldn't have been able to give you that number. I mean, I think another 3,000 counties. So I guess it makes sense that there's some multiple municipalities beyond that. But I was not aware. I myself was not aware there was 23,000. That's a big number.
Yeah. No. So you have 23,000 different communities. And of course, they all have their own unique issues. You know, and it's so funny when you think about it. But if anybody ever wants to look at a local government as if they're all the same, you know, I would challenge them to think about Scranton and then think about San Diego or think about, you know, Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania, or Manzanita, Oregon, on the coast of Oregon. Obviously, all very different. But, you know, you're working on something that's fascinating that they're all talking about. They're all talking about housing. And my instinct, my anecdote is, it doesn't matter if you're in a small mountain vacation town or if you're in a mid-sized city or if you're in one of America's big cities, they're all talking about housing. Give us just a quick recap. I mean, obviously, this is an issue that has been growing in a different way for a long time. But what's your quick analysis about how we're in this housing challenge?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things about housing affordability is if you look going back over time, you know, right now, there's very common for people to say we're in a housing affordability crisis. If you go back 10 years, the number and share of renters who were cost burdened actually wasn't that different than it is today. It has gotten a little bit worse over the last couple of years, but that's coming on the heels of having gotten a little bit better from, like, you know, 2010 to 2015. So we're not that far off. So why does it feel so much worse? And I think there's a couple of things about it. One is that the nature of the problem has become much more broadly felt. So if you go back, just like 20 years, the start of this century, it was almost entirely an issue of very poor people, very low income people who were struggling to make ends meet with their housing. As we go through the first two decades, two and a half decades of this century, the issue is now confronting not just people who are poor, but people who are working year-round full-time at decent-paying jobs. And so suddenly the issue of who's affected by housing affordability has grown dramatically. And so that's one reason why it's true everywhere, because you can go to, you know, take an example of a place where housing costs may not be that high. They're still going to have a whole lot of people at the lower end of the spectrum who are struggling to afford housing. So there's an issue there. When you go to San Diego, it's a much broader swath of people. They're both facing it. So I think that's the true part, the commonality. But I do think that the issue will manifest itself differently in different markets. And so that's one thing that makes it harder to craft a response is, in one place, you really need to be focused on very low-income renters. Other places, you need to be focused on moderate-income renters. Other places, you got to be thinking about first-time homebuyers. How do I keep folks who want to buy homes in my community? And, of course, in too many communities across the country, it's what about those folks who have fallen out the bottom, who don't have homes at all, or living on the street? So the housing affordability challenge is common to all these cities. How it manifests itself does vary, though.
You know, it's funny. I often think about there's a film that came out in 1946 called The Best Years of Our Lives, I believe, and it won an Academy Award. And what was neat about it was about these three soldiers who come back from World War II. And the wealthy guy, a man who had been a sergeant major in the war, and then they were showing how he went from being kind of a, I guess you'd call a sergeant major, almost kind of a mid-level manager level. You know, he wasn't an officer, he's now a commissioned officer, but he wasn't, you know, a private or a corporal. He actually, the wealthy guy, had been a banker in his real life. And they show how the juxtaposition of when he goes home, he actually was kind of the wealthier member of this group, but he lived in an apartment. And he raised an entire family in an apartment. Was the interesting thing about that was they showed in 1946 wealth of living in a multifamily dwelling and raising a family in a multifamily dwelling. Do you think that land use is probably at its core an issue that is at the center of a lot of these issues, where we're not maybe adapting new land use models to create different types of housing stock so that we have maybe more multifamily? Or a mix of different type of offerings for people so that they can find the home that's best for them?
It's definitely a key part of it, Matt. You know, I think that we have a lot of attention being paid these days to the fact that, A, we're not building enough housing. And by a variety of metrics, if you look at how many housing units we're adding relative to how many households, there is definitely, we're not keeping up. And to your point, there's also a question of what kind of housing are we building? And are we building the right kinds of housing, the right kind of places for folks? And essentially what we're building nowadays is either large single family housing or a kind of upper end multifamily housing. And why are we doing that? And part of it has to do with zoning and building codes, which don't get enough attention as well on the regulatory side. And so we favor single families, large lot, single family areas in our zoning. And to the extent we're going to allow multifamily, it tends to be higher density in good locations, the near transit, which is good. But there's all those, if you go to any community and you walk through communities, you'll find little apartment buildings in the middle of blocks that provide a lot of what some people refer to as naturally occurring affordable housing. It's simple, humble housing, lower scale, but it's that kind of housing a lot of zoning has eliminated from the landscape. Now, I do want to point out, though, and I had a conversation with several mayors at the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting that I think they feel a little picked on by saying it's all your fault because of the fact that you're not allowing your zoning, your regulatory processes to constrain. So if we imagine a world in which we took away that constraint and we say, let's build smaller, you know, higher density, less missing middle housing at a scale that it's needed, there's a couple of things that mean that it probably wouldn't solve the problem. One is that overall land prices are still really high. And the thing about land is that we're not making any more of it. And we're getting to be a bigger cities, bigger metropolitan areas, and a lot more wealthy people in those metropolitan areas that are all bidding up the price of land. So if you allow more dense housing, you'll make better use of that land, but it's still going to be pretty bloody expensive. And the other is then you still got to build that house, and the cost of materials, the cost of labor, the cost of financing are all very high these days. And so even under an optimal situation, it's going to be hard to build housing that's affordable for people at the low end. And more importantly, these days are more evident these days, people in the middle of the income distribution. So My conversations at the U.S. Conference of Mayors was a little bit of like mayors feel like everybody thinks it's zoning and it's only zoning. It is zoning, but it's not only zoning.
Right. Yeah, no, it is. My hunch is it's probably a lot of things that came all together once, and some of it over time, too. And it's such a challenging issue, but it's great to see the mayors dive in so deeply. You know, when I think back to local leaders, county leaders, city leaders around the country, from the most rural communities to the biggest cities, they're all talking about this. And I feel like they're all giving it a true innovative approach. Like, how do we truly try to address this in a manner so that it'll have an effective change, rather than just simply saying, you know, let's just build more rooftops? Maybe how do we change the dynamics of those rooftops and the communities where they're being built? Some, you know, giving people a greater experience in their community. Well, you know, for the idea that then we have the housing stock that people can afford, one of the things you've spoken about and written about is the importance of being able to have home ownership. I have to imagine that for local government leaders, they would want to see greater access to being for people to be able to buy a home for home ownership, that creates a level of wealth for folks. You've studied this. Talk to me a little bit about that. How might that impact a local community and an individual person?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I think what a lot of cities are experiencing these days is the kind of hollowing out of the middle, you know, that there are resources to build lower income housing. The low income housing tax credit program is an important resource. There's a legacy programs of public housing and other programs. And so there's ways in which we support that, you know, very low income household housing stock in a city. And then what you can afford to build is often higher end. And what's then missing is this housing that's for middle income folks. And often it's housing that's available to purchase. And so I think cities find that, you know, we're losing a big chunk of our population because to the extent that they want to aspire to home ownership, they can't find it in the city. And so they have to go elsewhere. Home ownership, as you say, I'm a big proponent of home ownership because of the fact that it allows you to control your housing costs. When you get that fixed rate mortgage, a big part of your housing cost is going to be fixed for 30 years if you keep the mortgage that long, and allow you to you know, withstand the ups and downs of the market, particularly the ups. You know, when we saw rents going up 20% during the peak of the pandemic, if I'm an owner with a fixed rate mortgage, my costs are staying steady. And so being insulated from rent increases, building that wealth over time that gives you more choice in the housing market, all those are really good reasons why you want to have home ownership opportunities. And as we were just talking about, you know, that entry-level home ownership requires a more modest home to be able to be that, you know, young family, young household who's trying to get into the market. So you need a simple single-family home. In denser urban areas, that might be a townhome. It might mean a condominium. It's that, again, that kind of missing middle housing that's so hard to build these days. And so cities can help by allowing for zoning that allows for that kind of higher density housing, small lots for single family homes. Underappreciated, I think, is the potential role of manufactured housing. A lot mm-hmm. of cities ought to be taking a look at their zoning, because oftentimes manufactured housing is precluded in single family zones as a form of, you know, blight. But today's, you know, manufactured home is not your grandfather's manufactured home. There are some really nice, simple, essentially ranch homes. So, and I think a part of the market that really needs more attention to is the condominium market. And there's ways in which liability issues have made developers more reluctant to take those on. There's issues in terms of getting bank financing, both for the construction of those projects and for the permanent financing for homeowners, that have created some challenges in that market. You know, back in the 1980s, when I came of age, it was a time when mortgage rates were in the teens. And what many people my age did was they got a condo as their foothold in the market. And we built a lot of condos. Nowadays, 5% of multifamily starts are condos. Wow. And so we really need to take a look at that market and say, what do we do to get that started as a way to give people a toehold in the homeowner market, and particularly in these denser urban areas in cities?
Oh, you know, absolutely. It's funny. I'm talking to you now from Mueller, which is a neighborhood in Austin. And I worked on this with the couple mayors I worked with. Is 700 some acres that was our previous inner city airport. And we redeveloped it in a very smart way, a very innovative approach to have a mix of housing. And I'm actually living in a row home. So here I am in a row home in Austin, Texas, and I bet you there can't be more than a handful of other row homes in the entire state of Texas. It wasn't a type of housing stock that was common in Texas, but it gave us that opportunity as a family to be able to move in here. The interesting thing for this neighborhood and some new neighborhoods that I think take a very smart approach, but they wanted to stay affordable, is they made such a community out of the redevelopment that there was such a desire to be here. Even though this was set up as an affordable housing community, it's gotten so expensive because everybody wants to be here. There's such a great, you know, there's a plethora of, you know, parks right. and pools and activity and, you know, sidewalks and stuff. So it's actually become the preferred model, I would say, for a lot of people who are coming to Central Texas. But to your point, you know, that being able to purchase here as a couple that got married, you know, a little later in life, had a child, at least for me, when I was becoming a little bit older, I won't say anything about my wife's age, but, you know, for me, I was getting a little older when we had our child. It did allow us to start that family process off. Now, you also have studied home ownership from the perspective of, you know, equality, who's getting into these, you know, homes, who's able to be able to afford homes. And when I look at different developments around the country, one thing that's clear too is that communities are that have a greater diversity, both, you know, of all levels, you know, socioeconomically, ethnically, you know, just people of different walks of life, they are clearly much more dynamic and fun and stronger. The more kind of when you're only kind of attracting the same type of people, especially maybe a socioeconomic level of person, just doesn't seem as fascinating. It does seem like diversity of all types adds to a greater strength. You study this from perspective of equality. Are we seeing it becoming more challenging for, you know, not just people of, you know, maybe challenged means, but also is it challenged for different people, maybe from different ethnicities or different you know, professions to be able to get into home ownership?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, particularly in the last 2 years, as well, if you go back 3 years, the start of the pandemic, the boom in home ownership, you know, suddenly we had a large millennial generation who had been delaying a lot of these transitions in life and found, wow, you know, I'm sitting in this apartment with my two kids in the city. Now we're all working, studying from home. We need more space. And so that push into home ownership happened really suddenly and pushed home prices up. So we saw a big jump in home prices, followed by a big jump in interest rates. So we saw the amount of income you needed to qualify for just the median price home in the country went from $70,000 in 2020 to $125,000 by 2024. That's a big jump. And that pushed millions of renters out of the realm of being able to afford a mortgage. And then if you look at who that impacts, again, people of color in general, you know, people in more modest occupations are going to really struggle to have that level of income. And if you think about the down payment you need for a house that's, say, about $400,000, even if you need just 3.5% down, you know, that's $12,000. And you figure that you're going to have closing costs about the same amount. You're talking about showing up on closing day with $25,000 in cash. That's a lot of savings for even the typical renter, but certainly for renters who don't have the benefit of, say, parents who have owned a home and might be able to make a loan from the bank of mom and dad to get you over the hump. So there's lots of ways in which the extreme unaffordability of entry-level home ownership have pushed a lot of people across the board out of the reach of that, but also particularly people who don't have family wealth, people whose incomes are lower. So that's a big part of what we're experiencing today. Which, you know, mind you, in 2020, from 2016 to 2020, we actually saw pretty good gains in home ownership among Black and Latino households. So that was a period of time before prices ran up when home ownership was relatively affordable and we were making some progress, but that's stopped now.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. I did not know that $50,000 jump in income, you know, in 4 years or 3 years, that's a lot. It's a big statistical move. So, you know, we may have a lot of local government leaders, community leaders who might tune into this show. Is there anything they could be doing, anything they could be concentrating on to help at home?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned earlier, Matt, you know, just how innovative mayors have been. And I do want to tip my hat. You know, I have for a long time looking at these issues, aside from the last couple of years, the issue of affordability had been growing, but it had gotten very little attention at higher levels of government. And mayors were the ones who couldn't ignore it. It was at their doorstep. And that, so that's one reason why a lot of the innovation is happening at the level of mayors. And so, you know, if you look across the country, you see what they're doing. And there's a lot of relaxing of zoning regulations. So many communities now, I mean, I think your city of Austin has been a big leader in allowing for backyard cottages or alleyway cottages, I think you call them in Austin, allowing for greater density around transit. When I was at the U.S. Conference of Mayors in September, there was examples, I think, of Austin and Cincinnati and San Diego, a panel of mayors talking about their look at the process for getting developments approved and how do we, you know, remove the frictions and the length of time that takes. So I think, you know, mayors are looking at the regulatory barriers, they're looking at the regulatory process, and they're also, when they can, looking for new sources of revenue to help close that gap. You know, what can we do to help, you know, bring down the cost of housing for lower income renters and first time home buyers? So what advice would I have? I mean, I think, keeping with the theme of our conversation around home ownership, you know, I think we're looking at over the next 10 or 20 years where this large millennial generation is still going to be moving through those years when they want to become homeowners. You know, I think we that leaning into how do we get more of a stock of housing that is providing those entry level options. And so taking a look at the condo market in your city, is there anything you could do as a mayor to help jumpstart the condo market, whether it's through zoning or approvals or whether or not it might be helping to support the development community to be able to develop the capacity to build small scale apartment buildings. There's the city of Boston, I know, is doing a lot with its stock of land. You know, the cities acquire small parcels of land over time, not big parcels of land, but they're here and there in neighborhoods. Can you use that to help cultivate the next generation of developers who can help build that missing middle housing? Are you allowing townhouses? What's your stand on manufactured homes? Are there ways in which you can bring some of those options into your community? So, but you know, I do want to tip my hat to mayors. I think many of them are looking at these things already, but there's a lot of good work happening again across cities. When I go to the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting and mayors are sharing those ideas, it's really gratifying to see.
You know, I got to give it to him. There's a mayor just north of Austin in Georgetown, Texas, Williamson County, Texas, where they were working with Icon, which is a 3D printed home company based here in Austin. And they put hundreds of new homes in place very quickly because of that process of a 3D printed home. Now, of course, like you said, with manufactured home, you have to get people to change the way they view this product as well. But it like with manufactured homes, it's not the manufactured home of my dad's era or my grandparents' era. These are nice, really new properties. 3D printed homes are also very cool. And you know, to your point too about condo ownership, I would just say for myself and my wife living in one, and going back to that reference of that film, The Best Years of Our Lives, it's also about making people feel comfortable that this is a good living experience. And it's a great living experience if you are in a place where you have a wonderful, you know, neighborhood access to stuff, even if your property or home might be a little smaller. Like in that film, the wealthy guy lived in the multifamily property and they had a great quality of life. Well,
you know, and Matt, you know this from living there, but the one thing about a townhome too is it gives you that access to the outdoors, right? So you can kind of be in that kind of, you know, multifamily density in the sense that you've got, you know, neighbors right adjacent to your walls, but you still have your own little backyard, maybe your own little front yard. So you have a lot of the benefits of that single family living. Plus, as you said, that density that creates community. So it's townhouses, I think, are really important missing piece of the housing puzzle.
Everybody has their own walk of life. I would never besmirch it. But the number of people I talk to who are living in kind of more of that townhome, condo, multifamily row home in a community that they like seem happier. The number of folks that I talk to who are in a 5,000 square foot McMansion far out of town, in a neighborhood that doesn't even have sidewalks, seem down. Right. And so I do think it's a neat part of life. You know, Chris, I think it's also another just interesting thing of people, what people could do is they could also follow you. So you are at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard. It's Chris Herbert. And I'm assuming, you know, publications, any interviews, things like that, you know, you have hosted there and people can follow and get more information, hopefully spark some innovation for them for what they can bring home to their community.
Sure, I'll give the shameless plug. So our website is jchs.harvard.edu. So that's Joint Center for Housing Studies, jchs.harvard.edu. And you can click to follow us. We put out two blogs a week on a whole host of topics around you name it and housing, from housing affordability, housing finance, housing design. We host events, a lot of those since the pandemic, we do virtually. So you can watch them live. You can watch them in our repository. And we put out reports and like. Our next report coming out in March is Improving America's Housing. It's all about what do we need to do to invest in existing homes, not just focus on new supply, but existing supply to keep it, you know, up to date, healthy, and sustainable. So yeah, I think following us is a great way to keep abreast of all these issues.
Absolutely. I love the idea of that study. And, you know, again, I can't tell you enough whether it's county leaders or city leaders around the country. They're all talking about this. They can go look at that website and get more information, follow you, and look at those studies as they come out. I know it's going to be great information. Chris Herbert, thank you so much for joining us here today. We appreciate you, and we'll catch up with you at the next Smart City Policy Stories.
Matt, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.